Today is February 12th. Today is Darwin Day. And in most college campuses, universities, science buildings, science departments, today's a big celebration. I remember last year I was in Iowa during this week, and I spoke at a college over there, and in the science building where I spoke, all the tables were plastered with books and literature and everything for people to take for free on Darwin, because it was Darwin's day that was being celebrated. And so, you know, when you think about this, I want to be sarcastic for a few minutes, and then we're going to get into the message that I do want to share with you today. But you look at some of the pictures online, when you look up a search for Darwin Day on Google Images, and you get some pretty interesting stuff. I mean, you get the Freedom From Religion Foundation is all about praising Darwin. Evolve beyond belief. That's wrong in so many levels that we could preach about that sign, but we're not going to, okay? Then there's, you know, Happy Darwin Day. Just people trying to be a bit creative. Darwin's claim to fame is the origin of the species, which you guys are obviously aware of. At least you've heard it if you haven't read it. But the origin of the species is what really, that's his claim to fame. Science will tell you that that is the foundation of all of science. Without that, we would be lost. If we did not have Darwin's theory, then what would happen with biology? Biology would be, you know, backwards. We'd still be in the Middle Ages. Like, he had this incredible breakthrough, and that breakthrough was natural selection, the process. He figured out the whole idea of natural selection. And that's his claim to fame, and that's his book. But how many of you know that he has a second book that he wrote, that that's his claim to shame? And it's interesting, because you do a Google search for Darwin writings, and this second book doesn't show up to like the 30th page. It's like buried. If he wrote a second book and he was so famous, why don't we read this book? Why isn't it summer reading in high school or college? Why isn't it part of curriculums? Does anybody know the name of that second book? It's called On the Descent of Man. The Descent of Man. He said, wow, that's his Origin of Species, Volume 2. A lot of people don't know about this book and its content. So what I find really ironic is that we're celebrating Darwin's Day, but do we really know who we're celebrating? Do we really want to celebrate this guy's life after some of the stuff he wrote? I mean, in this Descent of Man, I'm going to show you some stuff he wrote in here that is really wild, and that it's really ironic that we would take a second and celebrate this. It's almost as if either people are ignorant and they don't know about this, or they brush it aside and they won't really pay attention to it. Let's take a look at why that's his claim to shame, okay? It's ironic that today we celebrate the life of a man who hoped that the savage races, which included the blacks, would be exterminated. In The Descent of Man, Darwin believed and spoke about black people being less evolved than white people, closer to the animals than to the Caucasians. Okay? So this is in there. It's called social Darwinism, and it's in there. And don't take my word for it. This is right out of the book, chapter 6 on the affinities of genealogy. Listen to him. At some future period, not very distant and measured by centuries, the civilized races, that's white man, will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races, which later on he describes as Negro, Australian, or gorillas. Throughout the world, the break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will be intervene between man in a more civilized state, as we may hope, he hopes this, even that the Caucasian and some ape as low as a baboon, instead of as now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla. In other words, he was flat out against the propagation and the future expansion of the savage races. Those races needed to be exterminated so that we would have a clearer picture between the baboon and the Caucasian, and eliminate all the other savage races. Here's more irony for you, in case that's not enough irony. Today, black people celebrate the life of a man who thought that blacks were lesser evolved savages, okay? You look at, this is out of the New York Times, or the New York Tribune, I'm sorry, way back when. kindred of Stone Age men discovered on Antarctic Island, missing link with mankind in the early dawn of history. And those are people of color. They were the missing link. And finally, they figured this out. This is the epitome of what makes it so ironic that we celebrate today, Darwin's Day. Why don't you hear anything about this? And the interesting thing is, I did a search to see what, you know, what science people say and what philosophers say about his work on the descent of man. And here's what they all say. He wasn't really a racist. Politicians hijacked his ideas in order to force their views on people. The rich hijacked his ideas to make sure that the poor and the infirm and all that were done away with. And I'm thinking, like, really? How about we just read what he said and judge by that, as opposed to what you're telling me? Because when you read his words, it's like kind of obvious that he had racial problems. And then there was an honest guy today that I read who said, when he was in a debate with this other guy online, and all of these things were brought up, his response was, well, he was a man of his time, of the Victorian times. And the man of their time, well, you know, they thought that black people were less evolved than savages, but that was just because that was a man of his time. That's what people thought back then. And that somehow makes it okay? Just because people thought that, it's somehow okay? It's acceptable somehow? That's kind of weird. Here's more irony. Today, women celebrate the life of a man who thought men were superior to women in intelligence. Darwin thought that men were superior to women in intelligence for evolutionary reasons. Look at this quote, right out of The Descent of Man, page 564. The chief distinction in the intellectual powers of the two sexes is shown by man's attaining to a higher eminence in whatever he takes up than can woman. When requiring deep thought, reason, or imagination, or merely the use of senses and hands. And so he goes on to argue that if we make two lists and we see a comparison between men and women, there's no comparison. Men's minds are brilliant, women's are not there yet. And then he says at the bottom, you know, if men are capable of a decided preeminence over women in many subjects, the average of mental power in man must be above that of a woman. Okay, so ironic? Should we be celebrating the life of somebody who expressed what the views he did about colored people and the view he does about women? And we're celebrating him like he's the greatest hero ever? How come this never gets mentioned? How come we never hear this? I mean, really? That to me, it's kind of ironic. And what about the legacy? You say, well, you know, come on, that was in the Victorian times. Nobody really took that any further. Oh, really? Okay. His half-cousin, Francis Galton, was the first to form a eugenics society. If you don't know what eugenics is, a eugenic society, eugenics is the idea that we should genetically help evolution along, meaning that people that are infirm or less than perfect shouldn't be allowed to reproduce, so that they weed out and they don't mix with the higher developed of the race, and that way they don't devolve. To help evolution progress and not regress, we have to control the replication. We have to control the reproduction of people, okay? Galton proposed the idea of instituting breeding methods for humans, much like those used for livestock and other animals. Darwin's son, Leonard, succeeded Galton as the head of the Eugenics Society in 1911. In other words, legacy? Yeah. His family, his son, everybody continued in the application of these ideas. Because naturally, if you accept the theory that he was proposing of macroevolution, then you have to accept that, you know, we are developing and some are less developed than others. And, you know, we have to help natural selection along. We can't let, you know, the weaker or the infirm or colored people or people that have, any kind of disability reproduce. Because that's only going to bring more defective people into the problem. From the early 1900s to 1970, thousands of people were involuntarily sterilized in this country without their knowledge. We can go on and on about eugenics, okay? There's a lady called Margaret Stanger who was the founder of Planned Parenthood back in the early 1900s when this all began. And they opened their Planned Parenthood clinics in the ghetto, in the areas where were predominantly black people. And then they would offer free services to anybody who thought they were pregnant or anybody who wanted to have children. And when these black ladies would come in, they would sterilize the black ladies without the black ladies knowing it. They would sterilize them so that they could not have children. Because the mentality was, we can't allow them, the savages, to continue to reproduce. This happened here in this country, eugenics. And this is, the founder was a cousin or an uncle, and then after that, his son, Leonard Darwin, kept it going. This is the legacy. This is the legacy this man left when he was no longer around. The eugenics movement reportedly claimed close to 65,000 victims in 33 states in this country. 65,000 victims in 33 states. And that's not even touching abortion, because Planned Parenthood was precisely also an abortion factory. But if you look at the percentages of abortions, even today, abortions are far greater and higher percentages in black communities than in white communities. And it's slowly starting to come around, and Martin Luther King's daughter made a statement recently that said, you know what? Abortion is killing the black race. The abortion industry is killing colored people, is destroying us because of the incredible amounts of abortions that are done annually and the high percentage of among colored people. This is still today the effects of that. In 1904, in the World's Fair in St. Louis, Missouri, a special display area was set up using pygmies in order to demonstrate their lack of evolutionary progress. And this is a guy named Otto who they brought for an exhibit, and they put him in a zoo. There was a human being in the zoo, and his name was Otto, and he was there to show you what a less evolved creature looks like. But he was a human being. How was he less evolved? He was just had a different color skin. But he was less evolved. They had a display. They had him on display, which is incredible. We're celebrating this. You know, in 1904 World Fair, 2,000 primitive people were on display. The purpose of this display was to demonstrate the superiority of white Americans who had evolved further. This was on a special by Peter Jennings on ABC News. All of these people were gathered and shown in display, with the white people standing amongst them to show, look how much we've evolved versus all of these people. Less evolved. Many of those considered primitive people were the Native American Indians from this country, who were considered less evolved than the European Caucasian. Haeckel, Ernst Haeckel, who was a disciple of a student of Darwin, look what he said. The mental life of savages rises little above that of the higher mammals, especially the apes, with which they are genealogically connected. Their intelligence moves within the narrowest bounds, and one can no more or no less speak of their reason than that of the more intelligent animals. These lower races, such as the Vedas or the Australian Negroes, are psychologically nearer to the mammals, apes, or dogs than to civilized Europeans. We must therefore assign a totally different value to their lives. Really, they're worth less than white people. Really. This is what we're celebrating today. Darwin Day. Yay. Doesn't it make you happy to celebrate Darwin Day? I mean, think about, and here's the irony, okay? He thinks women are less intelligent than men, and here's a woman's going to speak on his behalf. Okay, Darwin Day 2015 with Dr. Eugenie Scott, chaired by Richard Dawkins. What would Darwin say to today's creationists? That took place today in London, that talk. So, ironic, isn't it? A woman, obviously far less intelligent than men, according to Darwin, is standing up and speaking on his behalf and celebrating his day. Okay? I think there's a better question we could ask. What would creationists say to Darwin today if he were around? And a lot of the people, a lot of the scientists at the Institute up in Seattle, the think tank for the intelligent design movement, which has really gotten together PhDs from all over the world in all of the branches, they're constantly saying the same thing. Darwin had no idea how complex life was. Darwin had no idea what the cell consisted of. You know, that's the whole theory behind the book, The Black Box, Darwin's Black Box. The cell was locked. It was a black box. Darwin didn't know what was in it. We know now. Darwin had no idea on what chemistry really was back then. It was not a developed science. There was so much he didn't know that obviously he was able to come up. We could understand how he came up with his theory. But the fact that it's still around today is mind-boggling when we know the complexities. So what I want to do today is briefly, I'm going to give you four reasons why Darwin was wrong and God was right. Four reasons why Darwin is wrong and God is right. And by the way, this is the kind of talk or the kind of phrases or the kind of information or ideas that will get you laughed out of a classroom in college. Mocked, laughed, and ridiculed. You're an idiot for believing this. For believing that God created the universe and believing that Genesis is right, you are the biggest idiot according to the world in which we live in. But I want to show you, because I think that, you know what really frustrates Darwinists and what really frustrates evolutionists and what really frustrates atheists? I think I've shown you the clip before where Bill Maher says we're all idiots because we believe in Noah's Ark. Here's what frustrates them so much. How could so many people still believe in creation? How come the vast majority of Americans still believe in creation? After all these years of education and evolution being taught in the schools and evolution being taught in the universities, man, how come we can't get these people to understand? How come the majority of Americans still, the vast majority of Americans still believe in creation and not in evolution? That's what frustrates them. And I'll tell you why. Because we have a brain and we use it, and it's called common sense. God gave us that common sense. Let me give you four reasons, and then I'm going to show you why it is scientifically more reasonable to believe that God created than we are the product of some random process. Arguments in favor of Genesis is a more scientifically reasonable. Argument number one, where did the information come from? Where did the information come from? Key question. That's a question you can ask any biologist, any biochemist, any chemist. Where did the information come from in DNA? Where did it come from? Information comes from minds. If you see a set of architectural drawings for a building like this, if you've seen them before, a building is constructed, I've been on construction sites and I've seen the building plans, you're talking about rolls of drawings that are this big rolled up. Maybe three or four rolls this big of detailed drawings for a building like this. You're talking about an enormous amount of detail. In there, you're going to find diagrams like these, which are called schedules. Door schedules, window schedules. That gives you the size and the details of every window in the building, the size and the details of every door in the building. That means the material it's made of, how it's installed, wind resistance, all the details about everything in the plan has schedules and schedules and more schedules. It's very tedious work, but it has to be there for the construction of a building. And then you have people who have to take these, you have people who have to draw this, design this, and then you have people who have to read it and build the building, okay? That is part of everyday life. We see that every day. Now, when we look at DNA, what we find is that the same way all of that information had to come from minds, DNA has to come from minds. DNA is like a set of blueprints for building a human body. And far more complex and far more details than any set of blueprints ever designed by any human. And not only do we carry the blueprints inside of us, but the cells are able to open the blueprints, read them, and assemble a human being inside the womb of a mother without any human or outside interference. And we somehow believe that there is no God, that this happens all randomly, of course. A set of beautiful, marvelous outlines are found in DNA. Detailed information, building instructions, material specifications, engineering calculations, everything is in there. In the DNA. DNA is based on specific alphabet arranged in a specific order following a specific syntax in order to convey specific information. That's found in each and every one of us. A full complement of human DNA has more than 3 billion individual characters arranged in such a way as to convey detailed instructions. It consists of incredibly meaningful volumes of useful, purposeful information. It's not just random letters and information. It's purposeful. If you have a box of, you know, when we were little, we used to eat this cereal that had letters. It's called alphabets. And we used to love that because we would play around and make words with it. So if you take a box of alphabets and it accidentally drops on the floor, you have all these letters scattered on the floor. That's meaningless. It's information because they're letters, but they're not saying anything. It's not really complex information. It's just randomly spread out. But if you walked in the kitchen in the morning and on top of the table you saw with the alphabet cereal, you know, the following sentence: please remember to throw out the trash, love mom, with the letters. I mean, you wouldn't think that the box fell and the letters just randomly organized themselves that way. No. A message conveyed like that comes from a mind. A message conveyed like that comes from a mind. But we see this in DNA, and how do you explain it if there is no mind, if there is no God, if it's all natural processes? What's the mind behind the information? Interestingly, when I use this, is part of a lot of this is from a debate I had last year in Iowa that some of you may have watched. And when my opponent talked about DNA, his only response to the whole DNA argument was that it's just an analogy. The whole alphabet thing is an analogy that we take too far. It's not really an alphabet. It's not really like letters and sentences. That's just an analogy we use. I think at that point, the entire science department of Iowa State went like, and he teaches here? Because this is, go to Barnes & Noble tonight or tomorrow. Go to the magazine. You know, Life has a whole special issue on DNA. It's this thick. And it goes through the entire architecture of DNA and the complexities of it from A through Z. Amazing magazine. Amazing. But that's just an analogy that we creationists use to try to prove something. The complexity is amazing. I'm not going to go in through all the details, but just incredible complexity. Where did the information come from? No entity in the known universe stores as much information as DNA. None. It's incredible. Each of us carry along 100 trillion cells full of information. All of us. And where did that information come from? That's the key. Now, here's where it comes up. If you're a naturalist, that means if you're a Darwinist, if you believe in evolution, your only answer to that would have to be that it came from a random, unguided, mindless process over billions of years. I'm going to argue that Genesis 1:1 is a better answer. In the beginning, God. Okay? So how do the two of them compare? Okay? Which view is more scientifically reasonable? The Genesis account, to me, is far more scientifically reasonable explanation because information comes from minds. And if I'm giving you an answer that there's a mind behind the information, that is scientifically reasonable. You, on the other hand, are telling me that there's all this information that didn't come from a mind. Okay, so what makes more sense? For an evolutionary theory to make more sense than a biblical theory of creation, we would have to have some kind of mechanism, some kind of device, some kind of explanation of how all of this information was generated by a non-intelligent entity. Okay, if all there was at the beginning was an explosion of matter, where did the information come from? Detailed assembly instructions for life. That to me is the strongest argument to show now that creation is far better answer than evolution. How do we explain the miracle of life? Okay, look at the diversity of life. Literally, I could have put 100,000 pictures here of the incredible beauty, colors, diversity, everything in life. Think about that. All of that is the product of blind chance. There was one cell, and that one original cell that nobody knows how it got here somehow developed into all of that? All of that? Or all of that? Not only do we have the animal kingdom, we have the plant kingdom and all the variety of plants and leaves and designs of flowers. I mean, life, the miracle of life. Where did life come from? At what point did inorganic, that means dead, matter become living matter? And how? How did it become living matter? That's, again, defies the theory. According to the predominant view of modern science, hydrogen, over billions of years, was what transformed itself into every living organism. All of the marvelous arrays of life and all their splendorous colors, shapes, designs can be traced back to hydrogen transforming itself. That's what the theory is. What was there at the beginning in the Big Bang? There was hydrogen and helium. That's it. So from hydrogen and helium, we have everything that we have now. And you're probably thinking, oh, come on, you're oversimplifying that. That's not really what they say. You know, this is a straw man you're building so that then you can destroy it. You know, that's not what Darwinism says. But here, watch this promo to an Emmy Award-winning science documentary on PBS called Journey of the Universe. Okay? This is a PBS documentary from scientists that are evolutionists, not Christians, not creationists. They believe in evolution. And here's how they introduce this series. Watch this video.
Over the course of 14 billion years, hydrogen gas transformed itself into mountains, butterflies, the music of Bach, and you and me.
Pretty good. A little bit of classical music in the background, and we believe it. For over 14 billion years, hydrogen gas transformed itself into mountains and butterflies, the music of Bach and you and I. Right. Right. That's scientifically reasonable. Of course, that makes a lot of sense. You know, that, obviously. How could we not get it? The authors of these, PhDs from University of Oregon, you know, he's the one author of that series. The other author of the series I thought I had here, okay, is a lady. Oh, well, there she is, Evelyn. She teaches at Yale and Columbia University. These are the people that made this documentary are not idiots. These are people that are really well prepared scientifically, and this is what they believe. I can understand why Darwin would postulate such nonsense in the 19th century, but why do we believe it in the 21st century? Why do we still believe this? It's absolutely ludicrous to believe this. Now, don't mistake. They say science understands there's a problem. So numerous theories have come up to try to explain how life arose from non-life. Numerous theories have been presented to try to explain this, how the first cell, incredibly complex as it is, came into being without appealing to God. There's actually six theories that have come out to try to explain this. And all six theories are shot down. Listen what Eugene Conan says. He's an American biologist and a senior investigator at the National Center for Biotechnology and Information Laboratory. At the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And his quote directly, I don't have it here, I didn't put the slide up by mistake. His quote is directly saying that there's no way, we don't know. After all of the attempts we've made and all of the conventions and conferences we've had and all the papers written, we still don't have a working theory about how life came from non-living. And this is somebody who knows what he's talking about. Harold Klein of the National Academy of Sciences, the simplest bacterium is so darn complicated from the point of view of a chemist that it's almost impossible to imagine that how it happened. We don't know. We don't know. And that's just the simplest bacteria. We don't know. Robert Shapiro, professor of chemistry at NYU, an expert on DNA, wrote a book where he totally tears apart and shows you the failure of all the theories of origins. He also says that the Bible theory is a failure too. It's one of the ones he rebukes. But when you read the book and he critiques the biblical account, his main argument for saying that the biblical account doesn't work is that it appeals to the supernatural. And there is no supernatural, so the explanation has to be natural. And since it appeals to the supernatural, it fails. That's his way of rejecting that. But all of the other six naturalistic theories, he breaks them down one by one and tells you how they don't work. Science knows that it doesn't work. There is a problem here of origins. So how do we explain the miracle of life? A naturalist would have to argue, based on his view, that they really don't have an answer. We don't know. None of the theories work, but someday we'll find out. We really don't know. My answer is that we do know. Genesis. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God. God is behind life. In the beginning, God created. And when you read Genesis 1 and 2, what did he create? He created all the diversity of life. And it's an explanation of an intelligent, powerful being creating it. So what is more reasonable? It came from nothing, or it came from a God? Obviously, I think the most scientifically reasonable is God. So Genesis is far more scientifically reasonable with regards to the miracle of life than Darwinism is. Number three, G.K. Chesterton says, it's absurd to complain that it's unthinkable for an unthinkable God to make everything out of nothing and then to pretend that it is more thinkable that nothing should turn itself into everything. Very clever. Chesterton had a way with words. He says, we can't accept that it was God, but we can accept that nothing turned itself into everything. Argument number three, how do we explain the marvelous design of the human body? I'll skim through this one real quick. When you look at our human body, the complexity of it is amazing. Amazing, just absolutely breathtaking. We have a skeletal system, muscular system, circulatory system, digestive system, urinary system, nervous system, reproductive system, lymphatic system, endocrine system, respiratory system, and there's a few others, but those are the main ones. Each of those systems is independent. Each of those systems is formed and built completely independently of all the other systems. Each of those are built from instructions in DNA. And here's an incredible part of this, that once each of these systems is built, they all work together. They all integrate. Not only are they built separately and they're separate systems, but they completely combine with each other and work separately and work completely together in unison. How does this happen? How do we account for all of these systems by chance? All the complexity of all these systems by chance. I don't know, did anybody ever go to the bodies exhibit when it was at Sunset Place? Any of you ever go? They had it there for the longest time. I went. I took a group of students from Florida Christian to see it. It is amazing. They have a body where they took off the entire nervous system of the body and they filled it with liquid, and all you see is the vein, the whole nervous system. And it's like a network of cables that is like breathtaking. It's incredibly complex. Then they did the same thing with all the vascular system, all the veins and arteries, red and blue, of the body, just the veins, and it's like, how does that happen by chance? It's incredible. Consider how all these systems work together perfectly. You know, the skeletal system and the muscular system all work together perfectly. You know, at the end of 9 months, you don't give birth to a sack of bones and muscles. You give birth to an individual who has all of these bones and muscles perfectly attached and connected and working tremendously. You realize that modern physics is a study begins with the human body. All of the developments in construction and all the machinery we see out there is an imitation of the human body. In construction sites, you see cranes. How do we invent cranes? We looked at the body. We looked at the arm. How we are able to pick up something and put it over here, they built a machine to try to do the same thing. It's not as flexible as a hand. It is a lot stronger because it's a lot bigger and it's made out of steel. But it imitates the hand, the pulleys, the levees. It's super complicated. Our skeletal system and muscular system working together is mind-boggling. Consider how the digestive system works to keep the entire body supplied with energy and nutrients. Knowing that what to absorb and what to discard from our diets, or how the respiratory systems provide oxygen needed to keep the brain alive, everything working. The whole body needs energy, so the digestive system, they're in charge. They take your food and they break it down and they supply the energy to everybody. Do you have anything that runs on batteries that will run on without having to change the batteries for 90 years? No. Everything, you have to change the batteries consistently. And recharge batteries, if you get rechargeable batteries, we know these mics, rechargeable batteries. They last for 3 messages and then you have to put another battery on. Sometimes not even that. You realize that our body runs on electricity? And you don't plug yourself into the wall at night to recharge? How does the electricity in your body keep you going for 90 years or more? We haven't been able to figure that out yet. If we did, we would try to design things that could last that long on electricity. We can't. Our body converts the food that we eat, the sunlight, the water we drink, it converts it into electrical energy for our body. And it keeps us going, and it keeps us going, and it keeps us going. That's how we recharge our batteries. We eat. And our body knows exactly how to convert that into electrical energy. How does that happen by chance? The body is a wonder of design. Consider how the nervous system runs everything from the center of operations in your brain, the entire body. It's incredible. Or the immune system, 24/7, and our entire lives vigilant against anything harmful attacking you, your body, from the inside or from the outside. the white blood cells, the whole immune system, everybody's attuned, everybody's ready to go. Anything happens to your body, your defenses immediately go to work. We have a body with an immune system, which is incredible. How about the reproductive system? All of these systems, organs, chemicals, features, everything that make up you, the body begin at conception. One single cell. The man puts 23 chromosomes, the woman puts 23 chromosomes. You have one egg, 46 chromosomes. It starts dividing itself. It starts splitting itself up. And every one of those copies has the entire genome of our human map, our entire DNA in it. And as it reproduces in the womb of the mother, some cells open up the chapter in the DNA through an incredibly complex copying machine that copies the DNA information from a given section and then takes it to the nucleus of the cell and assembles the proteins and puts it together. And one part builds a liver, another part builds a stomach, another group of cells build different parts of the brain. Other cells build each of the 200 different bones in our body in the perfect exact shape they need to be. And by the way, our bones, which are hard, are built to grow. They're built to grow. Our bones grow with us until a certain age, and then they stop growing. Hard and they grow. They're designed that way. Every single part of our body. And 9 months later, you give birth to a perfect baby with all of the systems working, everything working in conjunction, and everything perfectly designed and without human intervention. Nobody did anything. Nobody put a finger on that. Self-assembled from one cell. That's a miracle. It's called the miracle of life. How do we explain that? If there is no God and there is no creator and we had an explosion, how did hydrogen gas turn into that? Where did the information come from? How do we explain the diversity of life? And how do we explain life itself in the womb, the human body, and the design? So how would you explain this marvelous design? If you're a naturalist, a Darwinist, you have to explain it by unguided, undesigned. It's random. Sounds perfectly reasonable that all of that just happened by random. Random chance. Or you can believe what the Bible says. There was an intelligent designer who designed it that way and put it into action, his design. An all-knowing, powerful creator. He designed us, as the psalmist says, "For you created me in my innermost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well." The human body is a marvel of engineering, physics, biology, chemistry, and it has the fingerprint of God all over it. It is evidence that God was right and Darwin was wrong. The human body. Which of the views is more scientifically reasonable? The human body is a marvelous creation of Almighty God? Of course, is far more reasonable than to say that we just accidentally happened to come out this way. And the last argument, how do we account for the fine-tuning of the universe? The Earth is a magnetic field. The Earth has so many components that have to be perfectly precise for there to be human life, that just the fact that all of these work together, if you imagine a big, it's not like having a radio, okay? Having 10 radios and each of them is set to a different station, no. This is having one apparatus with all of these buttons. Everyone is perfectly fine-tuned. And by the way, they all have to work together. If this one changes a little bit, it damages all the other measurements. Everything is finely tuned and everything works perfectly together for life on Earth. How do we account for that? An incredible fine-tuning without which life would be impossible. There are 30 measurements, over 30 measurements, referred to as the constants of physics, that must be calibrated with extreme precision, not only in and of themselves, but in relation to each other. This is something disputed among scientists. It's not disputed, I'm sorry. Listen to Paul Davies, eminent British physicist, in his book, The Accidental Universe. I didn't bring the quote again, I'm sorry. His quote is very simple. He says, it's actually rather long, but he says that the odds, he's an evolutionary physicist, not a Christian. He says the odds of all of those coming together, all of those measurements, with the precision for human life to be able to live here is impossible. Science doesn't know how it happened. He's very honest. We don't know. We don't know how it could have happened. We have no idea that how everything came so balanced. Others say, well, multiple verses and all. Oh, there's a lot of theories to try to explain it. But imagine multiple universes. That explains it. There's millions and millions of universes. existing at the same time. So in one of them, the measurements have to be perfect for human life. Okay, and how do we explain that? What evidence do we have of anything other than one universe? Nothing. We don't even know the limits of this universe. Where are the other millions of universes that exist simultaneously? That's ridiculous. But it's an attempt to find some answer for this to happen. So how do we account for all of the fine-tuning? Naturalists would have to argue that, you know, based on their view, that it's just a coincidence. This is just one of those lucky galaxy, even luckier planet, that just happened to have arrived with incredible precision through unguided random processes to where we are today. My answer, Genesis 1 and 2. The fine-tuning is a result of an intelligent God that designed and created the earth and with the perfect precision for it to be inhabited. Which of you is more scientifically reasonable? We would be left with no rational choice but to agree with Paul Davies that the precision and fine-tuning points to a creator God. The Genesis account is far more scientifically reasonable than for the fine-tuning than the alternative view. You've seen four reasons tonight why. And there are many, many, many other reasons for us to be absolutely sure that creation is the way it happened, not evolution. Now, why are we seen as nuts and crazy people? Because we believe in God. That's why. God makes more sense as an answer to all of these questions. But if you believe that there is no God, then he's not a possible answer. So we must be nuts. That's why. That's why the rejection is there. It's the lack of faith that there is a God in the universe. Even though the evidence is there, Romans says that it's obvious to everybody. Just look around you. It's obvious that there is a God. Nature speaks of him. But people will reject it anyway. No matter what evidence you show them, people will reject it if they don't want to believe it. So I hope tonight you're encouraged to believe by knowing that what you believe is true. And I hope you're encouraged that it's not a good idea to celebrate Darwin Day. His ideas were not noteworthy. And his biases and his prejudices were very extreme to the point where I have no idea why people would celebrate it except maybe ignorance. They really don't know about his second book and they really don't know what he said in it. But it's not a day worth celebrating. Let's celebrate God Day. God did it, and he's the one that deserves all the praise and all the glory. And did he design us able to adapt? Absolutely. It's a little design feature in us. So even when microevolution works, it's a testament to his design ability, creating us able to adapt to our environment, which is powerful. So that's another talk for another day. So let's stand up tonight. As I was preparing for tonight, I had a choice. I said, I can talk about Valentine's Day, and we all got to love each other. Or I can talk about Darwin Day. And I felt Darwin Day would have been a better talk. So I hope you're able to process this, take the CD with you tonight when you leave, and be encouraged that you stand for truth. You know the truth. You are privileged in knowing the truth. But you live in a world that's not going to believe it. And they're going to mock you, and they're going to ridicule you. But until they have a better answer than you, you have nothing to be embarrassed about. My one question that I would always give you to ask anybody who challenges you this in a science field is, where did the information come from? You can answer that. If anybody can answer that for you, then we can have a conversation. Where did the information come from in DNA? That's bottom line. There are other good questions, but that's a good one. I'll give you one to take with you. Let's pray tonight.